All right. Welcome to another episode of Stories from a Bar. I'm your host, Chris Osborne. For this episode, I'm hanging out at Dancing Grain Farm Brewery. Is it Moreau? Is that how you
Moreau,
say it?
Moreau, yeah.
Moreau, awesome. I didn't think I was going to get that right on the first try.
Good job.
Hanging out in Moreau, New York, and I am joined by Rachel McDermott, founder here at Dancing Grain, and Chris Dufresne, better known as Duffy,
yep.
I believe.
Yep.
Awesome. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good. It's a good day. Nice day to be here.
It is. It was a beautiful drive up here, I have to say. We picked a good day, definitely a good day to do this.
Right.
First and foremost, thank you for taking the time to hang out and chat, of course. I'm sure farm life is busy, so I really appreciate
it's a busy time of year. Thank you for considering us, though. We're happy to be here.
I have been excited to get up here and check this place out because I've followed the social media since it's open. I've heard great things. Like I said, I live in Schenectady, so it was about a 50-minute drive or so. So it's not often I can get up this far north.
Yeah, makes sense.
But I was super excited to check this place out, and I drove by it, of course, the first time, because I wasn't sure where the hell I was, which is fine, because I got to see all the farmland around. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's mind-boggling. So how much acreage is the actual farm
area here? This piece of property, our farm consists of multiple pieces of property under my dad and my uncle's sort of operation. But this piece of property here is just under 310 acres.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is hard to wrap my head around because I'm not used to farming.
Right.
I think it takes me about an hour to cut my yard front and back. So
take you weeks to cut a yard that size. So it's about 310 acres. We refer to farmland as like tillable and non-tillable. So of that, 220 is actual production farmland, so tillable acreage. The farmstead's about 10 or 12 acres. We've got some very mature woods and wildlife that make up kind of the rest of it. So,
what's the craziest thing you've seen on the farm?
Oh, God.
What was the story you were telling me when you guys were, I was asking, you guys get any cats out here?
Well, I will. We went for a walk in February, like across the street where the woods are. And there was like these birds were just going nuts. And we're like, what's going on? We've got our son and our dog. And I look up and there's in the trees was a fisher cat.
Oh,
hunting, like right above us. We're like, wow. What? So that's fun. Coyotes. We hear coyotes in the middle of the night now, but when we first moved here, because no one lived here mm-hmm. for a long time, we would see them in the middle of the day.
Really?
We'd be out working, and they'd be like 100 yards from us.
That seems a little concerning.
Crazy. Yeah. They don't come by anymore, but yeah.
Didn't the bobcat come near you that one time?
Oh, there was. Yeah. Well, we
you
think it was a mountain lion.
And Sean was like,
yeah, it was a huge cat. We think it was a mountain lion. I was standing by the garden, and my husband's like, cat! And by the time I turned around, it had run through a cornfield, but it was huge. Like,
jeez.
So those are not selling points.
No. But it's fine. I mean, if you're hanging out in the tap room here, just getting hammered,
yeah,
you're
right.
Fine.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a fox actually come up to the door one night when,
did
everyone,
you really?
when everyone was here. Yeah, just kind of looking for food.
That's
cute.
That's pretty fun.
It was nighttime in winter.
Yeah.
So like.
Yeah, I see foxes around here frequently, coyotes, always, obviously, deer and turkeys.
Yeah, we do have like mascots that eat my yeah. barley.
Mascots, I like yeah. that. Yeah,
yeah, it's funny because they always. It's funny seeing the routines. Like, oh, turkeys are out. Like, oh, deer are out. Like, oh, okay, now it's
Rachel
their,
goes yeah. down, chases yeah. them away. 10 minutes later, they're back. Anyway,
we're gonna talk more about the farm, of course. But we got a couple beers. One I'm sipping on. One Duff, you're sipping on. I went with the Kolsch, which is absolutely delightful for
good.
Today.
Yes, thank you.
What's going on
so,
with this beer here?
So what's special about that beer is what we really try to do a lot here whenever we can is obviously use not just the grain and stuff that's obviously grown on the farm, but any, you know, anything and everything that we can forage to then think of, you know, random crazy things to do with beer that maybe nobody else has really thought of. So with that beer, you know, Rachel was telling me she has a lot of wild yarrow growing around, you know, the property. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they were using stuff like that before
Before hops.
You know, before they realized, You know, they obviously, they knew you needed something to offset the sweetness of the finished product. And before they discovered hops, the people were using stuff like Jarl. So that beer has absolutely no hops in it whatsoever.
Wow.
I just bittered it with Jarl and put some Jarl in kind of like as like a dry hop. So essentially used Jarl exactly the same way that you would use hops. Just not boiling them as long as you normally would in the kettle. Like I just put them like kind of like a Whirlpool edition and then
dry hop
it as like a dry hop as well.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I don't know if Duffy mentioned it, but when we brew here, we're very conscious of our impact on the world around us.
Yep.
You know, first and foremost, our land, because we need it to make a living, right? And its productive capability is the first and foremost thing when we think about like cash flow and profitability of a farm. Like the land has to be good,
mm-hmm.
right? So every time we do something, we take something from the land, we need to give back. And so all of our brewing stuff, we think of brewing as like a little bit different than I would say other breweries. We're thinking about it from the ground up. So, like, what is this beer's impact on the world around us? And Jarl is actually something that is native to our region. And in most, like, productive agricultural environments, considered a weed. Right? Lots of weeds, if you will,
really?
Are just native plants that are in the way. That they're not really weeds. They have medicinal or, you know, edible properties for centuries now, right? So instead of killing the Jarl, we give it space to grow in an area that doesn't conflict with our commercial agricultural practices. And then by clipping it, we encourage it to grow more. So we go out seasonally, harvest it, let it expand. He does something with it, right? It's sustainable.
Yeah.
So that's
everything
we kind of try and do here is like what's its impact, or how can we create a situation or a product that leaves this 300 acres better than it was before?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the philosophy, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, also too, due to that fact, it's very seasonal in the way we brew. So I'll kind of liken it in the way that you would, you know, see some of these, you know, a lot of these farm to table restaurants in certain areas. They'll focus on this is what's being served right now because this is what's in season. And I mean, that's the way humans were naturally for millennia up until refrigeration and all that kind of stuff, when you could just have whatever you want all the time. Everything was driven by the seasons and what was available at that time.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Yeah, so we do a lot of that here. That's why certain beers you won't see on tap year round, because we'll do like a rotating fruited sour beer, and you know, whatever fruit is in season at that time is the fruit you use. Okay. So I don't try to stretch it and get puree that's been, you know, sitting in some warehouse for God knows how long, treated with preservatives and everything.
That.
Yeah, we'll get our own fresh fruit and we'll make our own purees on site and throw it right in. And, it's a lot more fun working that way. It keeps things a lot more interesting than just being like, I'm just churning the same beers out all the time. You know, there's obviously the steady eddies we keep on, but then there's, okay, cool. You know, this time of year we're doing this time of year we're doing that. So,
yeah. And then Duffy's got the Sweet Bay, which,
yeah.
You know, the malt is grown here, mm-hmm. and, the honey is harvested from bees that are kept here. And it's interesting because the color from year to year is different. It's the same recipe, but it's a different outcome altogether, largely because of the food source from the bees from last year, right?
Yeah.
And depending on when you harvest
the honey. I was going to ask if it was because of from the bees. But
Yeah. And
so
again,
the year before, the bees were eating, they obviously ate off the sunflowers, but we had soybeans here, which is a plant that benefits from pollination. Last year, it was sunflowers and corn, so bees don't typically eat off of corn. They had to travel, right, or come over and eat from the cut flower garden or whatever. There was less, I would say, like, food source available in the immediate vicinity except for sunflowers in September. So it changed the color and consistency of that honey, which it's fun to see, right? Like, we have the data, we have the photographs to see, like, year to year what they look like.
That's really interesting. Has it had any impact on the flavor?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard to tell because, to be specific.
We don't have any left from last year.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's not, we don't brew it. It's not something that's brewed super regularly. So it's kind of hard to, like, remember what each batch tasted like. But yes, definitely. You know, it definitely has a flavor impact. You know, I think last year's was a little bit more, you know, it came out a little darker and it was a little bit more rich, I think.
It was a red tasting. Red color.
It was more amber. This is more like ambery. This is more like an orange.
Yeah.
So, but there's always that, I mean, obviously there's always that honey characteristic to it.
It also has to do with, like, what is, like, when it's harvested. The same with, like, maple syrup. An early maple syrup sap harvest is going to be lighter in color than a later, right? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, no, it's cool. We have fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. And Rachel, you went and got yourself something?
I got the Kolsch too. I figured I changed my mind. I'll have a beer with you guys.
It's just light.
Watch my row markers real close.
Like I said, I'm milking it myself. It was a 50-minute drive, so got to tame it in today.
Right?
At least until I get home.
Yeah, right.
And you have quite the fun history of the farm and stuff right on the website that I was looking through. And I think one of the most impressive things was it's basically a vertically integrated entire operation you have going on here. Is everything you need comes right from your farm, right?
For the most part, we do. Hops is one thing that we don't have on a commercial scale. It just doesn't really make a lot of sense for us since, you know, transitioning from growing commodities to growing small grains is a shared sort of resource, knowledge base, equipment. You know, we can kind of just deploy some of our bandwidth in a different direction. Hops is not that, but we are in the process. We found some wild hops here. So we are in the process of, like, digging them up, moving them, giving them space to grow, kind of figuring out what they can produce. I don't think, you know, from the farm's perspective, we grow enough for ourselves and we market some grain to malt houses and breweries and distilleries. And I don't think we'll do a commercial, like, planting of hops. I think it would be for us either on a wet hop basis or maybe we'll age them very old school way in, like, bales to use them for our, I guess I don't want to say farmhouses in, like, a stylistic sense, but our house beers, right? But, you know, that's going to be like a work in progress sort of thing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And was the farm, your father and uncle started the farm, right?
They started their farm business.
Their farm, back in the 80s.
And our home operations, our headquarters is actually located in Scaticoke. So that's where, like, all the grain from different farms and fields gets sort of combined and dried and stored and processed for delivery. Mm-hmm. The small grains, though, they come here. So, and they're grown here. We have deployed a very, like, intense cover cropping and rotational crop program here so that we can utilize this field for the production of our small grains every year. And that's because when you're here, right, you have to very intentionally come here. It's not like you walk down the street or it's 5 minutes from some people's houses, but broadly speaking, it is not 5 minutes away. It's not, you know, we're not in a downtown setting. So when you come here, you made a plan to come here. And we want to take that opportunity, that very, like, intentional mindset, to be intentional with what we share. And we want to be able from here for you to see what those crops are. Mm-hmm. And give you the chance to kind of immerse yourself in them and learn about beer from where it originates. And that's the soil, right? And a lot of what we do, like, we had an Earth Day cleanup event, and it was centered around, like, picking up litter, people's trash, that got blown into farm fields. And it's really incredible to see how our customer base connects with that very intentional kind of identity. Like, we want to care for the land around us because it gives us so much. And it's not just beer, right? Like, it sequesters carbon. Like, we can actually quantify, don't ask me right now, but we can quantify how different, like how much different crops actually sequester carbon out of the air and make the air cleaner. And that's, you know, that's really important to me. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different ways to make beer here around the world, right? But for us, focusing on local grown ingredients, whether we're growing them or somebody else is growing them, is probably the biggest impact on our environmental sustainability objectives, right?
Yeah.
We're not shipping and stuff from overseas or on the other side of the coast to do anything that we do. And that's something that I'm very proud of.
That's awesome. So the home base is Scaticoke. We're in Moreau.
Mm-hmm.
I have to think before I say that. So when did this land here come into the picture then that we're sitting on now and Dancing Grain is on?
Yeah, so I'm going to give you the brief fun history of this land. So there was this farm. We call this farm like in our record Z Farm, because originally back in early 1900s, the landowner's name was Ziak. He sold it to a guy named Dow, and that family, because a man from the Dow family married a woman from the Ziak family. So it kind of stayed in the family all through the 1900s, well, at least most of it. And then in the early 70s, Dow sold the farm to a man named Mr. Loeb. He's actually the ambassador to the Netherlands. He's a huge real estate investor.
Really?
Yep, and he had an investment vehicle who purchased the property. It was called Dream Street Capital, which is technically still around in some form today. I'm not sure what they invest in, but at the time they were investing in specifically like dairy assets. This was a dairy farm. Mm-hmm. Those old buildings out there were old dairy barns. And this was prior to the Tax Reform Act of 1984, so they could write off every dollar of investment made in the dairy industry. And they had like celebrity cows here because like celebrities were finding this loophole, right? So they'd have like $1 million cows because their semen's worth so much for like show cows. And
I never thought of that. I mean, you hear about that for horses and stuff like that. I never thought about it for cows.
Yeah. I mean, it's all breeding stock, like how productive are your animals and your herd. And it all goes back to genetics. So it was like a celebrity cow farm in the early 70s. And then the milking parlor, which is located where the parking lot currently is, it burned down in 1978, and Dream Street decided not to reinvest in the parlors. They got rid of the cows. But the original family stayed here. They lived here. They built a dirt bike track, and we actually have stickers. People will come here and be like, oh, my God, like the farm. They called it just the farm. They would have like dirt bike rallies here. My dad tells me stories of it. There'd be dozens of campers, hundreds of riders, like doing all sorts of risky, totally not like legal stuff.
Of course. Right?
And who knows what else. So, but my dad and my uncle picked up the lease. Mr. Loeb leased the farm to my dad and my uncle in 1983. And I was born in 86, or was it 84 that they leased it? Either way, before I was born. And they had the lease ever since. And in 2016, right about the time I left my job, Mr. Loeb called my family, and he was like, you know, I'm 90 years old and I'm going to die because we all die. And this is a piece of property you've taken care of. I want to sell it to you. So they were like very grateful for the opportunity. But it was, you know, a 7-figure investment. And we had leased all the tillable land, mm-hmm. right? The only thing that got added to the balance sheet really was the fact that now we have debt to pay instead of rent. And
always fun.
Right. And you're talking about a 30 or 40 year mortgage. My dad, and my uncle are in their 60s. Like, are they even going to be around to see it paid off? You know, that kind of concept of like, well, now the farm must have a succession plan. Mm-hmm. Like something has to come after. It's bigger than just myself. And, you know, they had been farming all the, again, that tillable land. So the only extra they got was this farmstead that was like left to complete ruin, right? Like everything's falling down. There was no roof here. All these buildings are more or less, this one's in better condition. We're putting some work into this building, but the house needed a complete gut job. I mean, everything here had a complete overhaul. And that was initiated by me because the reality is like, if you're going to pay debt, on it. You're going to pay your mortgage. Like, you have no more widgets to produce off of it, right? No more commodities to produce off of it to now make that payment. Something else needs to drive your return on investment.
Of course.
Because you've had all your corn and soybeans grown here for the last three decades, right? So that's kind of like how we started thinking about creating a concept where people could come to the farm and be part of what we do. And since we're grain farmers and not an apple orchard, right? Like the idea of ag tourism and come pick your own apples has been around for decades too, right? But we don't have a product that you can pick and consume. Our product needs to be sub-processed and then baked or fermented into something that you can consume. It's not a direct-to-consumer raw ingredient. So obviously there was a lot of planning involved. So, yeah. But that's how it kind of all came to be.
You mentioned leaving your job. Did I read this correctly? You were an investment banker down in New York City?
Yeah.
Before coming back
mm-hmm.
to take up farm?
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely a life, major life change.
Call me crazy.
What? So I guess first up, how'd you get into investment banking down in the city then? Because did you grow up
with the farm? I grew up on the farm. Yeah. Yeah.
So it wasn't anything unfamiliar to you when you came back. But.
Yeah. I mean, I learned most of my farm stuff through osmosis. You know, I was in giant tractors. Like that's my tractor. That's the first tractor I ever bought out there. And that's a baby tractor. It is by no means like a homeowner tractor, but like the tractors.
You never forget your first tractor.
Yeah. The tractors my dad and my uncle own are five times that size, huge machines. I don't need that for what I do for the brewery. But so most of the farming stuff is osmosis. I get a lot of support from them. But yeah, I went to Cornell. I got a business degree through the ag school. It's different setup now. And I graduated in 2008, which was like the last financial crisis, right? And I couldn't get a job in the finance industry. And I took a year off to like fold clothes at Kohl's or something. I'm like, wow, this like $150,000 education really took me places. But I project with Hurricane Ike back in 2008 that like destroyed an area outside of Houston. I went and I did relief work there that fall.
Okay.
So I got exposure to obviously a completely different region of America and networked my rear end off to get a job down there in a field that I studied. And so I started my career with Bank of America in Houston in their natural resources department, which is actually a nice way of saying oil and gas,
mm-hmm.
which is the literal opposite of what I currently do, right? Giving money to oil and gas companies. But it taught me a lot. And then I moved over to a French bank and focused more in exploration and production. So the valuation of natural resources. And then it gave me a lot of exposure to not just like oil and gas, but like mineral rights and air rights and water rights and all sorts of really complex ideas that change from state to state. Like who owns what's under the ground and how do you get it out?
Interesting.
Yeah. And then I transferred to New York within the same company to take a job in tech leveraged buyouts, which was, it was just like real tough. Couldn't have my horse, couldn't have my dog, it was just, so I quit and moved upstate and was like, I'm going to figure it out.
Boom.
Moved into the house I grew up in because it was vacant and I guess I figured it out.
No, that's awesome. Because, yeah, that's a huge life. Talk about a change.
Yeah.
Was the farm already in the business of selling grains and things to local breweries and distilleries?
No, or that was like totally my initiative.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because I was trying to find a way to like add value, right? I mean, here's the situation. When I was growing up, it's like this farm's growing and they're doing a really great job and the markets are different. So they kept investing in infrastructure to grow this business. But the farms, any farm is solely reliant on land availability to fill bins, to truck commodities, right? To sell stuff. You need land. It doesn't just like appear. And so they scaled all of that infrastructure to about a 5,000 acre farm. when I had left for school, we were farming about 2,500. So it makes sense. Okay, in the next 10 years between going to school and coming back from my job or whatever, that you could double the size of the business given where you were at. You're in a good position to make that expansion. But the reality of what really happened is, like, Saratoga County is the largest, fastest growing county in New York State. It's been that way for over a decade. People are moving here. Mm-hmm. The residential development pressure is huge. We've, you know, faced with all this solar development too. So in that 10-year period, they went from 2,500 acres to 1,200 acres.
Wow.
So when I came back, I was like, well, shit, like, we need to do more with less. Kind of going back to, like, our initial conversation about beer, how do we do more making less of an impact, right? How do we do everything we do is, like, let's do more with less of everything. And so the small grains program that we developed for breweries and distilleries was, like, these commodities are planted and harvested at different times outside of our core commodities. They take up less fertility. They are great for cover cropping. They help with soil erosion. We get more money for them, right? It was the concept of doing more with less. The reality of it all was, though, that malt barley hadn't been grown in New York State in 100 years, like basically since Prohibition. And your average farmer doesn't grow its commodities for germination, which is what you need to malt it. And the genetics available for barley, right? The climate has changed in 100 years. So the genetics of all these genetic traits of all these old strains of barley were, like, inadequate for our microclimates. And what really happened as a result of the farm brewery law was, like, catastrophic failures, spring and fall plantings for a few years. Like, everybody is losing their ass on barley. And I had to, like, drag my uncle and my dad, like, kicking and screaming, like, we have to do our own trials. Nobody's going to give us money to do this. We have to plant out different varieties, spring varieties, fall varieties. We have to figure out what's going to work for us so that we can market it. This is before we thought of a brewery. And so we did 5 sets of trials, which would be, like, 2.5 years. That could have been anything else that sold, right? Instead, this was, like, stuff we gave away to learn information and to share information across the industry. Here's what you should do. This is how much nitrogen you should put down. This is when you should harvest it. This is how you should dry it, right? Like, I mean, truckloads and truckloads and truckloads of just wasted grain.
Wow.
To figure out how to grow a quality product to make great beer. So I'm grateful for their help because, man, it was tough, but we did find varieties that work well for us.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the varieties that we have kind of deployed. And we do still, I'm like, this year we have a new variety we're testing. That's what we're doing today. When you walked in and you were like, what are these old dudes in this? What are they talking about? Pointing and spitting.
Well, I was just admiring the view.
But, like, we have a winter barley, which is over there, and which turkeys are eating right now. And that looks like it needs some nitrogen. So we'll be spreading nitrogen on that on Sunday because it's supposed to rain on Monday. Timing is everything.
Of course.
And then on this side of the field, we're doing a new strain of barley called Hudson NY that came out of the Cornell small grains trial. Because the spring barley that we would typically plant, a 6-row, we cannot find the seed for. Like, the seed stock is just missing. So we're trying a new variety this year and to be determined how it does, you know?
So you're doing all this testing, gathering all this information, doing the research, handing the stuff out by the truckload. At what point, and now you're finally figuring out what works and everything. At what point do you start thinking we should start our own brewery, tap room?
Yeah, about the point where I was like, I don't understand how all of these business owners that own distilleries and breweries and malt, how none of them know how to handle grain. It's like I'd get calls and be like, well, that rye that you dropped off in August is rotten. It's like, well, it's December. You asked me to mill it. Why is it sitting around? Right? Like, nobody knows anything. And it's an opportunity to teach and to be a resource at a bigger level for the industry, like a grain hub, which is, we actually submitted a grant to New York State for a grain hub. But the economics just aren't there. Like when you broker grain, let's just call it brokering, right? Like when you're handling grain, every single time you touch it, it costs you more money. And there's single digit margins at best if you have a good year, right? So like, why do I want to be in that business? If I'm trying to preserve this farm for succession, then I need to have a direct line of communication with the customer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to get that being the middleman.
No, not at all. Now, did you actually, had you brewed anything yourself before you started? Okay.
Never.
Because Duff literally here never. Is, of course, heading up the operation here. So you decide you want to have your own little tap room here to connect with the customers, but you are not the brewer yourself, or your husband, I assume?
No, my husband's an attorney.
Okay. Well, all your
He's a weekend
paperwork.
Farmer.
There you go. So how do you go about wanting to open a brewery like this and trying to find the perfect brewer then?
Oh, it's hard because like when you talk to brewers about what this concept of like growing your own ingredients and handling it on site and having like the freedom to create like your own beer, obviously within reason, beer that sells, right? It's like the sexiest thing a brewer's ever heard. There's no lack of interest, but there is a lack of understanding like the time frame and like what really goes into it. So like what was great about Duffy, he actually wasn't the first guy I hired. So, and it was a mistake because like, he could have been the first guy I hired. We interviewed a lot. I hired somebody else. I was like, this guy, I don't know. He's been in the industry for a while. Being a woman, the dynamic is strange, right? He's been in the industry a while. He knows a lot. Is he going to listen to me? I don't know if I can pay him enough, right? Like all this stuff, all these unknowns. And the reality is I should have just bit the bullet and hired Duffy because I made a mistake the first time around. But now I have him, so grateful. But just for instance, like that winter barley we planted in September of 2023 mm-hmm. makes beer for 2025.
Oh, wow.
So like understanding that this stuff doesn't happen overnight and there are complexities to what we do. There's high risk. For instance, I don't have farmers who grow malting barley in New York cannot get crop insurance for their barley. So like last year we lost 85% of our barley due to heaving. That's a climate change issue. Like wow. I have no control over that. I can't recoup that money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if I put $10,000 in the ground, that's $10,000 worth of malt we could have bought. That's a lot of malt. Instead, now we're like, how do we make more beer with less malt?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, it's a struggle. So it's not just like, I'm going to pick up a phone and order shit that I need. It's like, I have to really think about and plan and be detail-oriented. And every single kernel that comes through this brewery needs to be weighed. And we have to make sure our costs are in line because everything really does rest on what is our output, like, yield-wise? How is it selling? Because it all... Right. If the farm doesn't exist any longer because we lost money on it, neither does the brewery. Like it's not, they
hand,
are related. They depend on each other.
Yeah.
So Duffy has a ton of experience. I will not botch it by trying to speak for him, but yeah. He does. He comes with a huge background and maybe not so much like this microbrewery side of it, but everything he's done set him up to be able to do what we do here.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, and to that point, it's basically the range of style, you know, being able to do as much as you can with as little as possible.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to it. What'll taste good? What won't taste good? How can I get the most out of, you know, pretty much anything that I'm doing? And, you know, that's a big part of it. Just doing this long enough where I have enough experience to create a wide range of beers stylistically, not just rolling into a place and being like, well, all we're doing is hazy IPA. So, you know, just that's, you know.
Yeah, because you came, well, a lot of your experience, you worked at Schmaltz, they got taken over by Single Cut. Did you, and that's interesting. I haven't talked to someone in that position where you're working at some place and now somebody else is kind of taking that over.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was a godsend, honestly, because everyone was worried about losing their jobs.
Yeah.
You know, So we were just fortunate that the owner of Schmaltz, you know, had the wherewithal to, you know, sell the brewery to somebody who wanted to keep it going. So pretty much just everybody just kept their jobs, kept their positions. Just, it was just under different ownership.
Oh, that's great. And then, so what was it that when this opportunity came about to come here, I mean, what was it? Why was that so appealing for you?
Well, I mean, any brewer who gets into this, you know, for the right reasons, you know, this is ultimately the situation they want to end up in.
Oh,
no.
Hey, why?
You know, everybody wants to, you know, so kind of backing up, I got my start doing, you know, home brewing. So, you know, doing things on a smaller scale was always appealing because that's where you have your fun. You're not working with a lot of material. So if something doesn't go quite right, it's not that huge of a deal because you're just home brewing. But being on a scale like this, you have a lot of options and a lot of choices. You know, when you're working at a larger facility, you don't really have the option like, hey, let's do this crazy one-off Belgian beer and see how it does. Like, you can't do that because you made, you know, 50, 60 barrels.
Sheryl Crow.
Yes. You know, he made 50, 60 barrels of this stuff, so you got to make sure it sells.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the economics involved in it. Where on a scale like this, you know, and I got a lot of fermenters, so I can, you know, pretty much within reason, you know, hey, and if it, worst case scenario, it's just going to take us a little longer to sell through something than not. You know, we're not packaging up everything and having it sent all over the place, right? It's being brewed, packaged here, kept on premise, bought here. So I have all the control over, you know, the storage of everything. So yeah, it's a lot easier to come up with a bunch of one-offs. I mean, we're even to this day still kind of figuring out what our core brands are. We have, excuse me, we have a fairly decent idea. There's definitely a couple beers we keep on tap all the time, but we're still working out, you know, okay, we got 12 beers on tap. How do we want to parcel those out? Do we really want to focus on certain things, or, you know, right now our focus just is on variety.
Yep.
And that's the biggest, one of the best compliments we get when people come here is like, we would like to come here because there's a lot of different beer on tap. And every time we come in here, we know there's something different's going to be on tap. And it's not going into some tap room and being like, this is the same shit that was on tap last month when I was in here.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like that's just kind of, you know, not where I wanted to end up. You know, and doing that. And I had a bunch of brewer friends of mine when I actually started working here being like, dude, what are you crazy? Like, you're going backwards. Like, you're just supposed to be working at bigger places and then bigger places and then bigger places. I'm like, no, that's not what I want to do. You know, I mean, you know, not to be jumping around too much, but one of the biggest pet peeves that brewers have is they don't like being told what to do.
I've learned that.
Is an oxymoron because most brewers they have to do what they're told to do, and they have to make, okay, these are the beers we make. You've got no choice. You're working for me, and with here working with Rachel, you know, she may have like X, Y, and Z that she definitely wants me to do, but other than that, it's just like, hey, there's this idea. What do you think? Yeah, let's do it. You know, so. That in of itself is like any professional brewer would bend over backwards to be in a position like that. And, you know, I've been doing this professionally since like 2011, and I've always...
Is that when you started growing the beard? Because that's...
Well, I mean, I've always had a beard, but I mean, I stopped trimming it not that long ago, but, you know, I'm just kind of letting it fly now. But... You know, that's where every professional brewer in the back of their mind wants to wind up at. It's just a place where you just get to pretty much do whatever you want. And it really opened things up because I was getting stagnant, you know, just making the same beers all the time and not really designing recipes anymore. And, you know, that's... I 12 years later, 13 years later, winding up where I want to.
Yep.
And you know, even though it took that long, most people don't ever reach that.
No.
You know, most people are just, you know, and then it just becomes like a factory job. I'm just going in, punching the clock, pulling the same levers, pushing the same buttons.
Yeah, that's not even a Bruin specific situation. You're doing something long enough, it's just kind of on autopilot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I saw a lot of that. And it's just not, you know, it's not fun. It's a soul crusher. to be quite frank.
So do you have a favorite style you like to brew, or is experimenting, I mean, just really where it's at?
Experimenting is really where it's at. I mean, I don't get me wrong, I love my hazies, I love my hop forward beers, but what working here has really been giving me the option to do is, like, you know, make like a Kolsch with no hops, you know, mm-hmm. make, you know, I mean, this beer.
But did you talk about the total dankness?
Not yet.
Because
I'm getting there.
I have to hear one more person tell me you can't make a great IPA with New York State ingredients,
really
jump off a bridge.
Yeah, and I mean, more specifically, like hops. I mean, it's there's kind of a stigma on New York hops, and I mean, you know, the way
I'll come drink the total dankness, it'll change your mind.
Yeah, and I mean, even the crop top. I mean, they're really good beers. So I mean, what I'll say to that is, you know, yeah, if you're trying to be, you know, I was on the phone like a month or so ago with an individual that we buy hops off of, and I asked them about them. Like, have you gotten this? Have you had people say this to you? Like, you know, kind of turn their nose up at you and be like, you know, you really can't. And he goes, this is the situation. He's like, if you're trying to be one of those hype breweries that just has all hop forward beers on your tap list and you have 20 taps, yes, only procuring your hops from New York State would be pretty much impossible to compete with the other halves and the tree houses and all that kind of stuff, because we just simply don't have the plethora of varieties grown in New York State, because a lot of them are trademarked, so they're not grown, and sure enough, those are the hops that everybody likes to use. So they just have been conditioned to think, well, if I can't use those hops, then you just can't do it, which, you know, to me, being a brewer, it's just like, okay, well, then you figure it out. You figure out how to do it.
Right, you marry the two major ingredients together.
Yeah, and again, here, we have 12 beers on tap, and we'll have, you know, 2 to 3 to maybe 4 hop forwards. So,
which, by the way, is an impressive variety for the size of...
Yeah, well, I mean, it just goes to show you how much different types of beer you can make if you're not only just focusing on the hops. If you're not just focusing on the hops, you can make it really blows my mind that people don't take the opportunity.
I think part of that stigma, though, like a lot of these breweries, they built their brand on, you know, like their labels and stuff, like with Citra, Mosaic, Galaxy, right? They built their brand on that, so anything that deviates from that brand identity is scary, right? Because, hey, there's a lot of breweries out there now.
Oh, yeah.
No, you know? And I get it.
And from my perspective, like, it's not necessarily like, oh, we're going to battle against this. But that narrative directly negatively impacts me as a farmer, right? As somebody who's trying to preserve a working landscape in your backyard, right? That dialogue goes against everything that, like, lets me do my job. So it's a little bit of a contentious sort of topic from time to time, because I find that I can't, when I have a conversation with another professional brewery owner or brewer or whatever, that I come up against this quite often. And it's like, well, like, let's step back for a second. Like, it's all chemistry in the end, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's all just chemistry, like a little bit of this, a little bit less of that, like,
and that's how, and originally,
let's not say your beer is, my beer is worse than your beer. It's not what we're getting at here. It's just, I don't know. It's hard to have a response to that other than, here, just try it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Just try it. Tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah. No. And what I do a lot of times is, because, you know, sensory on pretty much anything is very subjective. So it's like, you know, have some of my beer geek friends around, I'll just put a beer in front of them. I won't even say anything about it. I'll just put it in front of them. Here, taste that. Oh my God, this is awesome. This is awesome. It's all New York State hops in that. And they won't believe you. They just, they're like, it's impossible. That's impossible.
It's crazy to just be stuck in that mindset.
Well, and the thing is, I get it because brewers get very, like, these are the ingredients I use and you don't want to deviate from that. And I get it. But at the same time, to just be totally nonchalant, be like, well, you just can't do it. Like, no, you just haven't tried to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you definitely can do it. But again, go back to my point. Yes, if I wanted to have 11 IPAs on tap, yes, only procuring hops from New York State, it would be a tall order. But I just want to have a handful of really good beers on tap. And I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, can you really tell the freaking difference after you've had two of them? Can you notice the difference? Oh, this one, instead of Mosaic Citra Galaxy, this one's Mosaic Citra Simcoe. You know what I mean? Like, it gets really ridiculous after a while.
I think at the end of the day, it's like, beer is our canvas to show what our farm and farmers in New York can produce. And that's really important, right? He's the artist, right? I'm giving him a canvas. And that's, at the end of the day, if all you want to drink is an IPA, we've got a few options for you.
Yeah.
But we're not a shop that's all we do.
Yeah.
Because the reality is our land produces an opportunity to make a lot of different styles of beer. And by God, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Of course.
And there are, and here's the thing. And I mean, this is getting into like more of an American beer culture thing. Something that sticks with me to this very day. And this was, you know, one of the guys who was one of my employees, you know, back in the day. And we were always trying to push, like, hey, you know, let's do a test batch of something different. Let's do this. Let's do that. And just, you know, always getting things shut down. And then, shit, I forgot where I was going with this. You might need to edit this.
See, I'm just going to brain fart. I'm leaving that part in.
This is it. Maybe, like, I give Duffy little projects to try all sorts of new stuff on.
Yeah.
We just did a project. So I have a sourdough starter that I started with grain from the farm on the farm. Like, this is, I guess, a yeast strain that is from here. So, like, taking it to the next level is like, okay, if our, you know, our grain's grown here and maybe whatever, let's say it's the Kolsch. Like, what if we could pitch our own yeast from here, not propagated yeast from a lab. Yeast from here, and not in a cool ship way that takes like a, I don't know, a lifetime to make beer, it seems. So we gave him this sourdough starter. I was like, make beer with this. And he's like, why? What are you doing, Rachel? And but what was interesting is I feed these starters different things. Mm-hmm. And depending on what I'm feeding them, one is like sour, like a sourdough, and one of them is completely bland. And I'm like, how would that translate to beer? Go. And we need to take it to the next step, right, which is climate control. Right now, we just pitched it into basically like a cardboard sort of situation. But before we waste a bunch of malt and whatnot, it was like, let's see what it does at all. And it actually was awesome. Like, I do think, like, our sours will probably transition to using that instead of a yogurt, which is how we sour it now. I think it'll transition to using our culture, you know, the yeast cultures that we have grown through our sourdough here. Yeah, because again, it's like, what is our house beer? What does our farm taste like? What does it produce? How does it produce it?
No, that's so
he gets a lot of
that's
flexibility to try different things.
Yeah, that's definitely one aspect of it. What this employee of mine said back in the day that resonated with me when we were just kind of, you know, commiserating over a beer after work, you know, he goes, people will drink something different if you give them the options.
Yeah.
So just nobody's doing that. Nobody's giving people the options.
Actually, we're giving them the options.
Well, that's what I'm, that, again, yeah. So that, so I,
well,
I
imagine,
my
well, that's
mind.
Part of being able to keep people coming back is to have a constant variety.
We have, so we kicked something off a CSA. It's called Beers and Blooms because we do a lot of flower stuff here too. Our brand does focus a lot on demographics that aren't typically targeted by craft beer industry. So women mostly. So the Beers and Bloom CSA, it's like, okay, you buy a subscription, you buy a share. It's a subscription. You get a 4-pack of beer and a big bundle of farm fresh flowers once a month. You pick it up. And each month that you get it, or you could do a 2-time a month pickup, whatever. Each month that you get it, it's a different beer. And it might be one of those things like, and it's kind of one of the points of a CSA is like, it's what's in season, right? It could be the crop top. It could be our IPA because that is the season. There's nothing fresh on the farm, right? Mm-hmm. Or it could be our Saison that we brewed yesterday with rose petals, right? Yeah. It could be whatever, our Belmont Lager, right? Whatever it is. And so it gives people an opportunity now to learn a little bit more about beer or to immerse themselves a little bit more in the process and the practice, something they may not have ordered even if they came here.
Yeah.
If all they drink are lagers or all they drink are IPAs, whatever, even though we have it here, they might not drink it. But we're giving them this in their share and we're telling them, you know, what to expect, how to taste it, what to eat it with, you know, what ingredients came from the farm, how they were handled and processed, right? I have to go take care of something that broke.
That's fine. Okay. I appreciate you taking the time to hang out. I'll close out with Duffy.
Yeah. Talk to me as long as you want.
Well, we're nearing the hour mark anyway, but so I want to wrap up with one question. We talked a lot about being able to experiment on this. Is there, like, what are your hopes for the particular brewery here? Like, is there something you haven't brewed but you're itching to do?
What I really, really want, I mean, this will take some infrastructure, but we've got plenty of that here. It's just a matter of slowly fixing stuff and creating, you know, I really want to do a really serious barrel aging and, like, sour project here.
Really?
So right now I do kettle sours, but I'd really like to do something like legit that is done all and take the time with it. Like do like a real creek, do like, you know, do something that takes like years in the barrel to create, you know, that kind of stuff. That's the stuff that's really fascinating to me. I'm a huge chemistry guy. I love fermentation. So that is the stuff that is really more alluring to me than a lot of the turn and burn stuff. Just making beer as quick as you can, get it on tap.
Yeah.
Obviously the economics surrounding that are, you know, a little bit different.
just
but,
a skosh.
Yeah. But I mean, but again, being here, it's like it's the options are wide open and, you know, and Rachel respects me to the point where she's, you know, what do you need to do this? I need this to do this. Okay, we'll get it. You know, like, so she doesn't second guess me all the time and blah, 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 and this and that and this and that. She trusts that I'm the professional just as much as I trust that she knows what she's doing with the farming and stuff like that. And she's going to provide me with quality grains to use. She's also trusting me with, you know, the background that I have to just be able to make all. And I think a lot of stuff like that will be a little bit more conducive to the type of setting that we have.
Well, it definitely sounds like you guys have an awesome working relationship. Yeah. This Kolsch is delicious. And this is just a beautiful place all around here. So you guys are doing awesome work. So I think that's going to wrap it up.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
That's another edition of Stories from a Bar for the people out there listening to this. Big thank you, Rachel, who of course had to run off. Duffy, thank you for hanging out to wrap things up on the show. Again, I appreciate you taking the time to hang out and talk about this place and yourself and the beers and everything. This has been real fun.
Alrighty.
If you're not doing it already, go like, follow, subscribe all the social media pages for Dancing Grain. Keep tabs on anything going on. Any last minute stuff you want to throw in? No? You're shaking your head.
Yeah.
All right. Huge thank you out there to everyone for checking out the show. You can, of course, follow Stories from a Bar on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at StoriesFAB to keep up with everything going on with the show and my adventures in podcasting for all kinds of local breweries, music, and really shit I love, essentially. You'll find Stories from a Bar on all major podcast platforms. Be sure to like, subscribe, even more importantly, leave fantastic reviews and share the hell out of it. So until next time, cheers.